This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. And now you can try a bottle yourself, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and it's year-end and it's winter time, and our thoughts are turning towards the cold, challenging months ahead where immune systems are really put to the test. And so it's appropriate that today we visit the subject of immunity with one of my favorite guests. He's really a point-and-shoot expert on a wide variety of subjects. We've turned to him in the past. When we wanted to talk about selecting the right omega-3 fatty acid supplements. Also, we did an excellent podcast with him recently on adrenal function and the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. Also, we talked to him to push back on supplement critics in 2015. Those have been some great podcasts with today's guest, Dr. Thomas Gwilliams. Dr. Gwilliams' recent book, Supporting Immune Function, A Lifestyle and Nutrient Approach, is the latest in his Principles and Protocols for Healthcare Professionals line of resources. Now, these books are challenging. They're great for health professionals and for enlightened laypersons. You can find those books at pointinstitute.org. The book outlines the basic principles of immunology for today's practicing clinician, as well as lifestyle, nutritional, and dietary supplemental approaches to building and maintaining a healthy immune system. That's what we're going to talk about today. Dr. Gwilliams currently is the Vice President of Science and Regulatory Affairs for Orthomolecular Products, and he is also a teacher at the University of Wisconsin School of Pharmacy, and is the author of some excellent monographs and books, which you can find out about at pointinstitute.org. So without further ado, here's our guest, Dr. Thomas Gwilliams. Tom, it's a pleasure having you back on Intelligent Medicine.
It's great to be back with you again.
Okay, so frame the issue for us. When we talk about immunity, is it fair to talk about boosting immunity, or is that a misnomer?
Well, I mean, the immune system, of course, this time of year, like you mentioned, people are more concerned about it than ever. We think of cold and flu season and these kind of things, and we start thinking about our immune system, which sort of goes unnoticed oftentimes the rest of the year if we don't have any other issues going on. So let me back up just a couple steps and just mention that really our immune system, if you want to just simplify the idea of what the immune system is there to do, is to differentiate self from non-self. You know, self we think of as being not harmful to ourselves. We don't want to harm our own cells, but we do want to be able to recognize those things that are in our body or on our body that could be harmful to us. And most of those things initially are going to be non-self. So things like viruses and bacteria, cells from other organisms or other people. And some of those cells, as you know, are good cells, like the good bacteria in our gut, but the immune system has to be able to first see them as what they are and then decide whether they're dangerous or not. So when we think of that in a general sense, do we want to boost the immune system? Well, I would think the better term is we want to modulate the immune system. We want to make it more capable of recognizing and recognizing harmful things, harmful organisms, and make the immune system better at recognizing them and also better at defeating them. But boosting the immune system is maybe too general of a term, I think, although in some cases we can generally upregulate the immune system, and as long as there are only bad guys out there, that's good. It's possible, I think, but it's very rare to boost the immune system that triggers something autoimmune. Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen very often, and that usually means the person is already out of regulation in a way that is a problem already.
You know, that actually speaks to an issue that sometimes confuses conventional doctors, because they see patients sometimes who are taking a lot of supplements, and they may say, hey, you know, don't take all those supplements because they're going to boost your immunity. And say the person has an autoimmune condition like multiple sclerosis, or perhaps ulcerative colitis, or rheumatoid arthritis. They said, don't take those supplements. Stop taking those supplements because they will boost your immune system. They might make your condition worse. Is this or even echinacea? Echinacea has actually been in the crosshairs, as you know. A lot of controversy about echinacea. Could it be bad for people with autoimmunity? Should you take it all the time? Might it rev up your immune system too much? So what's your take on that?
So if you look for this, so, you know, we hear that quite a bit, that if somebody has an autoimmune condition like some of the ones you mentioned, that taking something that, quote, boosts the immune system will somehow trigger an autoimmune response or make it worse. There's really no evidence for that. We don't see that in the literature. It's been looked for in a number of different cases. So even though the logic would say that there likely could be something like that, we just don't see that. And it's likely because the immune system is a little more complicated than just, you know, turning it on and turning it off.
In other words, it's not like a rheostat or a dimmer switch. It's not just, bidirectional.
Right. And especially when it comes to autoimmunity, there are many different, unfortunately, regulatory processes that have gone amiss in autoimmune conditions, but very rarely do you just upregulate the autoimmune response in sort of a blanket approach. In many cases, these, you know, echinacea, like you mentioned, or other things like beta-glucan from mushrooms, these things stimulate the immune system in a very basic way, but the immune system doesn't lose its regulatory capacity to know self from non-self just because you've stimulated the immune system.
Okay, so let's kind of draw back a little bit, because in a moment we're going to talk about specific supplements, because I think a lot of our listeners are interested in a menu of possibilities that they can use for immune support. But backing up, talk a little bit about some of the general lifestyle influences on immunity.
So yeah, I think the bigger picture that I like to talk about when I think of the immune system is that really what you're trying to do, hopefully throughout the year, but maybe people need to do it more consistently during these months, is you want to build what I call the metabolic reserve, the reserve capacity of the immune system. And that, you know, you're not just thinking of immune cells per se, you're really thinking of a lot of the resources that the immune system draws upon. So things like building the antioxidant reserve of the body. So throughout the year, this can be done through the diet, of course, and maybe through supplementation, building micronutrients, so vitamins and minerals, because all of these, you know, we think of them as just generic, you know, vitamins and minerals, but the immune system needs them at higher, we know the immune cells, when they're activated, use a lot more nutrients, a lot more energy. So anything that's going to help build the capacity of the energy of the cells, the mitochondrial health of the cells, the immune function, it draws upon, you know, more energy. It also draws upon, you know, what we think of as micronutrients, vitamins and minerals, because all these enzymes that are working in these cells require these vitamins and minerals as cofactors. So, you know, these are why obviously people are, you know, thinking about, you know, certain vitamins and mineral supplementation, why we see in the literature that people consume these have reduced infection rates and these kinds of things. But it really, it's something that you can build the capacity of, not just after you get, you know, the cold or a flu, but it's something you really want to begin doing ahead of time. The other big area that I think that people don't think about, and I know a lot of clinicians are starting to think about, is the idea of building what I call a commensal-friendly environment. That is, when we think of commensal organisms, those are the good bacteria that live with us, and you can do that by eating right, perhaps by adding probiotics and fiber and things that help the good bacteria, especially in our gut, although it's not just in our gut, But these are things that we can do, because as most people may now start realizing that the good bacteria in our gut manage a lot more than just what goes on in the gut. They actually train the immune system, and perhaps are the most important components of training our immune system to be able to function properly. So if we've changed our diet, let's say we go into the winter months, we're not eating fruits and vegetables as much because they're not available at the market as readily. We start eating maybe Thanksgiving, Christmas, all the different holidays, a lot of different types of foods, more refined sugars. All of a sudden, our bacteria in the gut completely change, and our immune system starts responding in an inappropriate way, more inflammation, less immune protection. And so we can do a lot in our day-to-day life just by the way that we're living. Obviously, the classic, you know, hygiene-type things, washing our hands, protecting ourselves that way, but in the dietary area and in the way that we build our reserve capacity for the immune system to function properly.
Is there such a thing as an immunosuppressive diet? You know, you mentioned sugar. Is there evidence that a certain pattern of eating, it robs the immune system of reserve, or chemicalized foods perhaps have an adverse effect on immune function?
Well, certainly we can rob our immune system of the available nutrients it needs to function, like I said, with reducing the reserve capacity of vitamins, minerals, antioxidants. Certainly, if we increase the types of foods that cause, for instance, food allergies that cause inflammation, mm-hmm. you're now going to trigger the immune system to be, in a sense, you're going to overactivate the immune system, but you're going to activate it to food particles, and so you're going to create a depletion of the immune system because it's going to be using itself up in that area. The other area that you and I have talked about in the past is the role of stress. And not only are there foods that can drive stress, obviously our stressful environment. Well, the stress hormone cortisol is a major immune suppressor. We know that, of course, that's true when you give, corticosteroid therapy, it suppresses the immune system. And sometimes that's what we're actually trying to do, although that can have negative consequences long term. But stress in and of itself is a major, major immune suppressing hormone, cortisol is, and so stress is going to be a major problem. And of course, people oftentimes are stressed around the end of the year, beginning of the year, for various reasons as well. So these are all kinds of things that we need to avoid if we want to help out our immune system.
And of course, the role of sleep, vital for immune function.
Well, exactly. Sleep is important, and not only is it connected with all the things that we mentioned as far as stress and the immune system directly, but so sleep is a major, and our body tells us, of course, when we have colds and flus, one of the first things our body tells us is we need more sleep. And so we're put in that situation where, the body's trying to gain sort of its reserve capacity, its metabolic capacity by essentially making you unconscious so that it can start repairing itself mm-hmm. without you getting in the way.
Yeah, it's almost like nature's way of forcing you to rest is, you release all these cytokines when you're sick and you just feel like lying on the sofa and napping.
Exactly. And probably the last thing, not the last thing, but one of the things we should mention is physical activity. Mm-hmm. In the winter months, people are usually less active, and it's not well understood, but modest amount of exercise is what we might call an adaptogen. It helps create a good stress on the cells and on the immune system and allows them to adapt very well and creates a good modulation of the immune system. Being sedentary is poor, but also over-exercising. So if we exercise too much, like people are trying to do marathons and some of these sort of large, long, strenuous sorts of events, they can actually be immune suppressing. And so people need to be very aware that if they're going to do something like that, and especially if they're training for something like that, they need to be aware that it is going to be a consequence on the immune system, and they need to build as much reserve capacity as they can and maybe plan afterwards to avoid places where they may come into contact with extra bacteria and viruses.
I think there have been some classic studies on marathoners who, as you say, very frequently come down with upper respiratory infections. I know I've had that experience myself. Taking preloading with vitamin C and taking vitamin C for some period after completing a marathon, and thus dramatically reducing the incidence of typical upper respiratory infections that they get post post-exertional. Are you familiar with some of those studies?
So, right, there's a number of different studies that have looked at this, and of course, this is also not only immune suppression, sort of self-induced immune suppression, if you want to call it, and also self-induced stress response, because cortisol levels go up very high. And a number of different studies have looked at things like vitamin C, like you mentioned, probably the one that's been studied the most, and phosphatidylserine, for instance, to try to reduce the cortisol levels. Some of these have been more successful than others, and clearly, the vitamin C studies, I think, have been helpful, but they still don't bring you back down to the level that maybe you would have been had not exerted yourself. But certainly, there's ways of protecting yourself. Hydration is another one. A lot of people get dehydrated during those experiences, which then have consequences on mucosal membranes and other things as well.
So this season, they're exhorting us to take the vaccine. You know, whether it be the shingles vaccine or the pneumonia vaccine, or most popularly the flu vaccine, and yet there's some bad news about the flu vaccine this year. There's actually some thought-provoking studies that suggest that if you take the flu vaccine on an annual basis, like they say, you do less well than if you take it intermittently, say every few years or every other year. Paradoxically, seems to work that way. And then there's some bad news about the flu vaccine and statin use. It seems that individuals who take statins have less immune response, antibody production or antibody response when they take a vaccine. And so that kind of leaves us with a dilemma of, like, you know, should we be vaccinating, or are there other ways to perhaps boost our immunity this time of year?
Well, jumping into a controversial topic, whether or not to vaccinate, there's a lot of different layers of decisions. I think you're right that the process, as you know, of creating the flu vaccine itself is based on trying to predict what is going to be the most active viral strains or for that year. And my opinion is that they often miss, sometimes woefully miss, the likely strains that are going to be there. So
I think
I'm
by one statistic, it was 14% effective, at least last year, by various estimates. Of course, it depends on who you talk to. But that, you know, it's kind of like long-range weather forecasting, and sometimes they nail it and sometimes they don't.
Exactly. And so I think more consistently, I think people really should be thinking, rather than whether they choose or not to choose the flu vaccine, I think really they should be thinking about building the metabolic capacity, the metabolic reserve, because as has been shown clearly in the literature over and over, there are lots of ways of modulating whether somebody has an immune response to the flu vaccine itself. Mm-hmm. This has been done many times, showing that there are many ways of you just because you inject somebody with the vaccine does not mean they are going to have an appropriate response. And a lot of that has to do with their immune system's ability to respond. And so the things that I mentioned, I think, are more consistently helpful in a broader range of individuals, whether they have the vaccine or not.
Are there not some studies that, you know, even accepting the notion that universal vaccination, where people get the flu shot, particularly older individuals, the very people we want to protect against the flu, may have a less robust immune response to the vaccine. The vaccine doesn't necessarily take for them, and that the addition of certain nutrients, I recall some studies looking at vitamin E, for example, augments their potential to be successfully vaccinated.
You're exactly right. Obviously, the older an individual is, the fewer naive cells, B and T cells, that enable them to respond to a new antigen. So a new vaccine that they've never come into contact with has to be able to stimulate some naive B and T cells. And so, or in some cases, if they've responded to in the past, memory B and T cells. But you're right, if you have more of a more robust capacity, I think the studies on vitamin C, on vitamin E, and others have shown that you could increase, and so this is oftentimes what they look at, is the increased capacity to respond to vaccination, because and as you know, most vaccines, if they were just given by themselves, if we just gave attenuated virus or some sort of virus protein, the immune system doesn't respond immediately. So it's what we typically call an adjuvant. We stick something in the vaccine that is supposed to, quote, stimulate the immune system. What I usually say, it's like a kick in the teeth, and you get the immune system a little mad, and then all of a sudden it starts saying, well, what made me mad? And then it runs into this vaccine and tries to mount a response against that. Well, that's something that we can do if we're constantly if we have good bacteria in our gut and we've got a good, robust immune system. It should constantly be being looking for these things. When our immune system is down or suppressed or not active, you have to give it some sort of adjuvant, like lipopolysaccharide or something like that, to really stimulate the immune system, which is sort of an artificial way to do it.
Well, lipopolysaccharide sounds a little bit like polysaccharides, and that's what these beta-glucans products are like, things that are mushroom-derived, things like active hexose-correlated compounds. Is that why they're successful at boosting immune response, because they do kind of wake up the immune system?
Just to back up one step here, our immune system obviously is designed to recognize self and non-self and things that are potentially dangerous. And, of course, they use all kinds of receptors on their tissues and on their cells to basically try to recognize what's out there. And what we've learned is that there's a number of cells that have receptors that recognize a variety of patterns. That's why we call them pattern recognition receptors. And one of the series of patterns that they're really good at recognizing are the patterns of lipopolysaccharides, like you mentioned, flagella and other proteins that find themselves on the outside of bacteria and viruses. And when they come into contact with these, they send signals to the immune system to trigger a response that says, hey, you know, I'm seeing these types of organisms, we should upregulate this part of the immune system. And because of these polysaccharide patterns are also cross-reactive with things on mushrooms and things on yeast beta-glucans. And so, historically, the use of mushroom or mushroom extracts, you know, I think even the Iceman, this Iceman that was found frozen from thousands of years ago, in his satchel, he had some of these mushrooms, and
wow.
It looked like it was small portions, likely maybe
Ufi or Udi or whatever his name was, the Austrian Iceman.
Yeah, I forget his name was.
Utsi, yeah.
But we've known in the literature, and you go back to ancient Chinese, traditional Chinese medicine from thousands of years ago, you go to the Middle East, and you go even to native populations, mushrooms have always been part of the immune, or they didn't really call it immune system, but, you know, sort of the ability to block sort of infectious diseases. And it's likely because when you consume mushrooms, many of the mushrooms, they have these polysaccharides that then stimulate the immune system. They kind of create this sort of immune system. And it's interesting that when do a lot of these mushrooms fruit? Most of them come in the fall. And so if you look at that, it's sort of like a seasonal way to gather up mushrooms, and so it becomes a seasonal immune stimulation in the fall through the winter, and probably most cultures would need it the most. And so not surprisingly, many of these have now made their way into dietary supplements in extracted forms or concentrated forms. And a lot of the research on mushroom extracts, as you know, is in cancer research, because of the stimulation of the immune system there. You know, dietary supplements can't really make claims on cancer, but the same sorts of mechanisms that upregulate and modulate the immune system would, you know, for instance, upregulating natural killer cell activity or modulating T cells and B cells are clearly going to be beneficial for other things as well. It's just that the research area on cancer seems to be a little more, an area that people want to make claims about, or at least want to research about, I should say, where claims can't be made about that in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the most popular mushroom products is from Japan, where it's actually considered a medicinal, and even, I think, paid by National Health Insurance, through National Health Insurance over there. It's the AHCC, or one brand name here,
right,
is Impower.
Exactly.
Which is the beta-glucans extract, initially yeast-derived. All right, good stuff. You know, for our listening audience, they recognize that we divide these podcasts into two parts. This is a great introduction to the subject of immunity with today's guest, Dr. Thomas Gwilliams. And you can learn more at his website. It's pointinstitute.org. And, in fact, you can order there this outstanding monograph. It's very, very sophisticated and detailed. It's great for health professionals, but also for enlightened laypersons. It's it's entitled Supporting Immune Function, A Lifestyle and Nutrient Approach. And in part two, coming up, we're going to focus in on specific nutrients that help to optimize and support immune function. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.